Thank you very much. It's lovely to be with you, with a home crowd, and to speak about this subject, which has occupied quite a few years of my life, but I don't get to talk about it in church very often. So it's lovely to have this chance. I wonder if I could begin a little bit of a preamble before I get into the technicality of the talk, just by asking you to think about what it is that guides us in our discipleship. It's our relationship with Jesus. And how do we know what we know about Jesus? Combination of factors, what we read in the Gospels, what we learn from the first Christians, what we learn from the Christian tradition, from our personal experience. And so in our journey of discipleship, there is a small part, but it's only part, which comes from the fruits of scholarship. That scholarship can tell us some things about the Gospels, tell us some things about Jesus, and that can help to guide us in our following of him. So we can value scholarship that takes us closer to the historical Jesus. And we probably want to be wary of scholarship that is false or distracting. But I hope we're interested in scholarship that is true. Now, truth is a difficult concept, and it's hard to know you've really grasped it. But I hope what we'll do this morning is to get a little bit closer to things that are true while recognizing the complete provisionality of that process. What we're really doing this morning is history. And we're engaging with history, looking down a tunnel which is 2,000 years long, which means that our capacity to see a whole picture is very limited. But I hope we'll see something which is true, or maybe a little bit more true than what we might have seen before. So in a moment, when I start clicking the slides, I'm going to take you on a journey into scholarship. And that can be quite a tricky thing to do. It can be disturbing. You might even be shocked by what I tell you this morning, because, let's see if you are or not. I think some of it's shocking. Some of it might amuse you, and some might take a little longer to process than we have here and now. And I'm very happy to engage in further conversations. We're neighbours, after all. Just to reassure you, though, that for me, this journey has led to what I hope is a clearer understanding of the challenge offered by Jesus. Recognizing that I don't see with total clarity, but I'm really drawn into that process. In Mark's Gospel, but if you read Mark's Gospel, one of the impressions that comes across quite strongly, I think, is of somebody who's kind of swishing his cape and walking into the distance in a very enigmatic way, and his disciples are thinking, what's going on here? And they kind of trot after him to try and work out the next bit, not doing very well. And my journey as a scholar has been rather like that. Jesus is a character who draws me into a place which is not secure. I don't know what's going on, but I find him to be a faithful companion in that process. As I try to piece together history, I very much feel this is part of my Christian vocation. It's part of my what it means for me to follow Jesus, to try and explore more closely who he was, what he said, what he calls us to do. Now, so a couple of other warnings. One is that there's a lot of simplification that's going to come into this talk. You might say, at the end of it, you might say, you simplified that. Just because in the space that we have here, it's not possible to say everything with legal accuracy. It just takes too long and it's confusing. What I will try to do is to say things which I think, if I say this is, just believe me, this is true, I think that there's such a high probability that it's worth just saying that. But everything is contingent. All things are challengeable in this field. And it might also be worth giving you just check that we all know what a synoptic gospel is, because they're going to feature quite heavily in what we're doing together. The Synoptic Gospels are Matthew, Mark, and Luke. I hope you can read the diagram I have here of them. In all seriousness, you just need to be able to see the colours here. The screen is not that bright, and the screen will have a lot of detailed material on it, which again, you just need to be able to see the colours, but you might find you have a better experience if you sit where Brian and Linda are, or fill in some of these spaces at the front if you're right at the back. Can I give you the opportunity now to come nearer, because you might thank me for taking that chance now rather than thinking, I can't see and that's disturbing me.
The Anglicans are going to sit at the back.
Okay. Well, maybe after the break. There should be more content after the break, so you might like to come forward then. And they're called synoptic because it's possible to see some passages in parallel to one another. So the red material here is what's common to Mark, Matthew, and Luke. The blue material is what's common to Luke and Matthew. The yellow is what's only in Luke, and the white is what's only in Matthew. So now I'm really determined that you're all going to travel every step of the way with me on this journey. I really, really do not want you to think this is over my head, because I think quite a serious crime has been committed by scholarship. And it's been committed because people tend to abdicate or defer to so-called experts. And one of the things we're going to see this morning is that the so-called experts are sometimes really wrong. And I want you to have the confidence to say, I can see why they're really wrong. And I'm not going to say just because they're a fancy professor in a fancy university, they must be right. Because you can appreciate for me, as a vicar of a North Yorkshire church, I come up against that all the time. This professor and this professor must be right because they're professors at fancy universities. And Gary must be wrong because he's a vicar in a North Yorkshire town. Let's go with the evidence rather than the reputations. Agreed? So, in the history of scholarship, as in history more generally, sometimes small incidents have big consequences. And in the history of the study of the synoptic problem, which is the question of the relationship between Matthew, Mark, and Luke, who copied from whom? Why have they got so much material in common? There is one page of one book that's had a particularly big influence, and it's page 183 of B.H. Streeter's The Four Gospels, which was published in 1924. And on this page, which is just that one there, he sets out the basis of the argument for the existence of Q. I will explain what Q is in more detail shortly. Now, this is a very important page in scholarship. It's not to say that nobody had thought of Q beforehand or given reasons for it afterwards, but it's just a particular hinge moment in history. Because what Streeter did was essentially to argue that there's something like a Berlin Wall between Matthew and Luke. So that where there's material in common, the blue patches on this diagram, this can't be because Matthew copied Luke or Luke copied Matthew, because there's a Berlin Wall between them. So the common material must have come from somewhere else. And that somewhere else is what scholars call Q, probably short for Quelle, the German word for source, just a set of Jesus saying, which was out there somewhere, which was known to Matthew and Luke, which is why they have so much material in common. Are you all with me so far?
Why is there a Berlin Wall between?
That's what Streeter produces arguments for, and I'm going to demonstrate to you that the Berlin Wall is a fantasy. So the blue material is there because they're both copying from Q. I'm going to represent that same diagram, but from a different elevation, like that. Yes, still with me? And I'm going to build for you what's called the two-document hypothesis, which is the heir of Streeter's proposal. I need you to trust me that Mark comes first. It's disputed, but there's really good reasons for thinking that Mark was the earliest of those three Gospels, and that Matthew and Luke both copied from him. The reason for thinking that is that there's the levels of verbatim copying are so high, and the order in which episodes are recalled is so similar that it's very unlikely that they're using shared oral traditions or that they're different perspectives by different eyewitnesses. I think it is extremely likely that Matthew and Luke directly copied from Mark. Now, I'm just going to massage this diagram very slightly to make it look like what you would have seen if you've ever studied the synoptic problem before. Yeah? And what's interesting about this is that Matthew and Luke's treatment of Mark, you might expect to be quite similar to Matthew and Mark's. Matthew and Luke's, it's very easy to do that. Matthew and Luke's treatment of Mark is likely to be very similar to Matthew and Luke's treatment of Q. Can you see why that would be the case? So Mark's really useful as a kind of a control. You can say, well, if scholars say that Matthew and Luke would treat Q in this way, is that the way he treats Mark? And if it is, that's a good argument for Q. And if it isn't, that might challenge the Q hypothesis. So let's take away the Berlin Wall. And well, what's interesting about this proposal is that it generates the need for this entity Q. And Q has generated a lot of fun in popular culture. Here's a book by a man called James Hall Roberts. On the back cover it has, why did Red China want the Q document? Why did the Vatican send someone to buy it? Why did the Nazis believe in it, even though it was discovered by this discoverer was a Jew? Why did a Catholic priest now contemplate murder because of it? What did the Q document reveal? So this is kind of someone picking up the scholarly idea and turning it into a piece of popular fiction. Q also appears in the Da Vinci Code. Here's Lee Teabing in rather faded light. And he says this in Da Vinci Code: eyewitness accounts of the Songreal treasure describe it as being carried in four enormous trunks. Also rumored to be part of the treasure is the legendary Q document, a manuscript that even the Vatican admit they believe exists, which is one of the few things that's true in the Da Vinci Code. Allegedly, it is a book of Jesus' teachings, possibly written in his own hand. So, it's quite fun. Popular hokum, but it is based on very serious and expensive scholarship. This is the front cover of the critical edition of Q, which is one of the fruits of the International Q Project, which is a very respectable and expensive enterprise, which has been going since 1983. It's got 48 lead scholars and lots of students employed to help in the process. They've published 12 volumes. You can see that this top volume here covers 1.5 verses. And you can't quite see because of the quality of the image, but there's a stack of books which I created here, which is about that high, which is that when the whole project is finished, if it ever is, then there'll be about 11,000 pages. The whole thing will cost you nearly £2,000. And the text that they're reconstructing and studying and trying to work out what the original words of were is about the length of Galatians, according to their proposal. This is just to give you a sense of how much is invested in this theory. It's the most expensive project in New Testament studies ever, sucking in more scholars and more students than any other. The problem is that Berlin Wall that is necessary for the Q hypothesis to work and be necessary is a fantasy. And it's a fantasy because it's based on two logical errors. And I really want you to I'm going to test you on whether you grasp what these logical errors are, right? So trust yourself. The thing which makes people distrust themselves is they think, it can't be that simple. Surely, for the last 90 years, scholars that we respect have not been so stupid as to fall for this same mistake again and again. But they really have. So the first problem I've called the Streeter fallacy. And the start of it is actually logically not bad. It's fine. It's the second part that's a problem. Let's work with the bit that works to start off with. Sometimes it is Matthew, and sometimes it is Luke, who gives a saying in what is clearly the more original form. Just in brackets, never trust a scholar who says anything is clear. It's always a cover for something not being clear. But allowing in that, it's a matter of scholarly judgment whether something is more primitive than the other, but we'll concede the point that this is a fair description of what we have. And then he says, this is explicable if both are drawing from the same source, each making slight modifications of his own. This is true. Let me explain to you why it's true. Imagine we've got two versions of Goldilocks and the Three Bears, one by Helen, one by Mike. Now, Helen's version is more primitive in having walking, whereas Mike has skating. Mike's is more primitive in having porridge, whereas Helen's has ready break. Helen has chairs, Mike has beanbags. Mike has beds, and Helen has futons. Now, this is a phenomenon which is called alternating primitivity. Just a useful technical term to log as we make our way through this. And alternating primitivity suggests that Helen isn't straightforwardly copying from Mike, and Mike isn't straightforwardly copying from Luke, from Helen, but it seems that they're probably both copying from Gerald. Gerald has everything in the most primitive form, and Helen modifies it in some ways, Mike modifies it in other ways, and that's how you get the phenomenon of alternating primitivity, which relies on existence of an earlier source, in this case, Gerald's. Are you with me so far? Okay. So that's all fine. The problem is that Streeter then goes on to make another statement that isn't true. That this phenomenon of alternating primitivity is not explicable if either Matthew and Luke is dependent on the other. I'll explain to you why that's the case, or why this isn't the case. According to Streeter, Tatian is the author of a quite an important text called the Diatessaron at the end of the 2nd century, which was an attempt to harmonize the four Gospels. He sometimes has a more primitive version of Mark than Luke does. And Luke sometimes has a more primitive version of Mark than Tatian does. Now, if Streeter was right, this would mean that Tatian is not allowed to use Luke as well. Well, that's plainly rubbish. We know that Tatian uses Luke. He says so. And the same applies with Matthew and Luke. Just because they might share a common source, which generates this phenomenon of alternating primitivity sometimes, that doesn't mean that Matthew is not allowed to also use Luke directly, or Luke to use Matthew directly. I'm going to pause, and I'm going to ask you if you follow what I'm saying so far. Okay. Yeah? There's a little bit more, so I'm going to come back to the Goldilocks in a second, so just to, because it's a really, really important point. Yeah.
Do we know for sure who wrote what in what order, Matthew Mark?
For the purposes of this exercise, we know for sure, in brackets, that Mark is first. We don't know for sure who comes next, Matthew and Luke. We're going to try and tidy that up as we go along. Feel free to keep interjecting, Tim. And it doesn't matter whether our common source is Mark or X or Y or whatever we want to call it. Just because there's a common source, it doesn't mean to say that Matthew and Luke aren't allowed to have any direct contact. Now, so Streeter wrote the Four Gospels in 1924. Here's David Catchpole. He moves. David Catchpole saying, the implications of alternating primitivity is pointedly set out by B.H. Streeter. The more such discoveries pile up, the less sustainable is the notion that Luke used Matthew, and by inference that Matthew used Luke. It's not true. The more those occasions pile up, the more likely it is that there's a common source, but it has absolutely no relevance to the question of whether there's direct copying between Matthew and Luke. Similarly, Chris Tuckett, sometimes Matthew, sometimes Luke seems to be the more original at different points. This, it is said, tells heavily against any theory of direct dependence of Luke or Matthew, or brackets, Matthew on Luke. But you can see it's not true going back to Goldilocks, because yes, Mike and Helen might have been copying from Gerald, but when it comes to their final line, there's nothing to stop Mike from copying from Helen directly. So that's the first hole in the Berlin Wall. Still allowing for a common source used by Matthew and Luke, but there's nothing to stop them copying one another. The second problem is, I call, Streeter's unfinished argument. So how are we to account for the common matter? DT stands for double tradition, which is a technical term we use to describe the blue material, which is what appears in Matthew and Luke. The triple tradition is what appears in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the pink. How are we to account for this blue material? The obvious suggestion, note that phrase, that Luke knew Matthew's gospel, or vice versa, and derived from it some of his materials, breaks down for two reasons. The first is alternating primitivity, and I hope I've just proved to you that alternating primitivity has no relevance at all to whether Matthew used Luke or Luke used Matthew. And the second argument is quite good arguments for thinking that, the second point is quite good arguments for thinking that Luke did not use Matthew. So we're edging a little bit closer. If we can show that Luke didn't use Matthew, then that's an important stage in the process of putting them in a particular order. Now, his arguments for saying that Luke didn't use Matthew, which I'm going to have to be to summarize for the sake of time, are what might be called the problem of unpicking. Which is to say, we've got here this Greek text, but all you need to be able to see is the colour. So I hope you're able to see the difference between orange and green. If Luke is using Matthew, then he has to go into Matthew and, with surgical precision, remove Matthew's additions to Mark. That's a very difficult thing to do. Can you see? If you can't see, you need to come nearer. Yeah? What we've got is, so there's a patch of green there, a patch of orange there, and a patch of green there. Everything in this is green, everything in this is orange. Now, if Luke is using Matthew, he has to go into Matthew, take just that bit, not take any of that bit, just take that bit, not take any of that bit, which means you've got to have fully memorized or be keenly aware of exactly what Mark says so you can deliberately miss out what Mark has to say and then go on. That's a really, really difficult thing to do. Here's another example. It's the power of the mustard seed. Can you see we've got Matthew got a bit of orange, bit of green, bit of orange, bit of green, bit of orange, bit of green. Luke would have to unpick Matthew's additions to Mark in order to create his text. Not very likely. Another problem is what we call the problem of order to chaos. So in the Sermon on the Mount is usually used as the classic example of this. The Sermon on the Mount is quite an ordered discourse where Matthew arranges Jesus' teaching on the law in the first section, and it works its way through to everything that just kind of Jesus' ethical teaching in one easy installment, combined in one place. But in Luke's gospel, The same material occurs in Luke 6, Luke 14, Luke 11, Luke 16, Luke 12, Luke 16, Luke 6, Luke 11, Luke 12, Luke 11, Luke 16, Luke 12, Luke 6, Luke 11, Luke 6, Luke 13, Luke 6, Luke 13, Luke 6. So if Luke is copying from Matthew, what we have to imagine that he does is he thinks, oh, I like the material, but I don't like it in this order. What I'm going to do is to take a bit of this, and then I'll save that bit for later on. I'll take a bit of that. I'll say that bit for another place later on. It's just a very complicated thing to do. It's not impossible, but it's not straightforward at all. And you kind of think, why would you bother to mess up the Sermon on the Mount? So those are quite good reasons. I've got more, but there's not time for them, for thinking that Luke could not have known Matthew. And on the strength of them, we can be sure that Matthew didn't know Luke, according to Streeter. Just going to pause to let that sink in. It's not true, is it? Matthew never unpicks. He only combines. So say Matthew was interested in gathering what his sources had to say about false Christs and false prophets. He knew that Mark had material on it and Luke had material on it. Then he would combine it together. It's the same thing that Tatian does at the end of the second century. Same deal. It's hard work, but it's not an illogical thing to want to do. And we've got other examples which demonstrate that it is practically possible to do it. And again, he's got the Mark's version of the power of the mustard seed and Luke's version, and he knits them together to create a third version. And then Matthew never scatters. So we can see that if he's got all those resources about Jesus teaching on the law spread through Luke's gospel, when he's creating the Sermon on the Mount, he gathers material relevant. So Jesus teaching on murder goes through Luke's gospel. Everything that might fit into that category is taken from Luke and put in that place. Goes down to the next subject. Goes through Luke in order. Everything that fits that subject is taken from Luke and put in Matthew's gospel. So he's gathering into one place, a handy place for Jesus' ethical teaching, Jesus' teaching on the law. It's a difficult operation, but it's not an illogical one. It's the kind of thing that Matthew does all the time, bringing like material together into one place from different sources. So the arguments for Luke can't have known Matthew don't work for Matthew can't have known Luke, but that's exactly what Streeter proposed. And amazingly, those arguments have continued to have traction. For various reasons, which Tuggett does not articulate, excuse my tone of voice, Matthean dependence on Luke is hardly ever advocated, though one sometimes wonders why, given the tendency of many to believe that Luke's version is very often more original. It might amuse you to know that Chris Tuckett was my doctoral supervisor. Here's a particularly favourite quotation of mine from a lovely man called Mark Goodacre. He's a professor at Duke University in America. He went through Oxford a little before me. The theory that Matthew has read Luke is rarely put forward by sensible scholars, and so will not be considered here. Now, he's got a bit cross with me for pulling him up on this by saying this isn't quite fair because the state of scholarship in 2001, he heard me give a paper in 2000, actually, but you know, books take about a year in the process of publication, so it's quite reasonable that he would have written this line before he'd heard my paper. He said the state of scholarship at that time was that hardly anybody was proposing that Matthew used Luke, and things have moved on quite a lot since then, but it was fair enough to say, nobody's tried it, so I'm not going to try it either. I dispute that. I think if you've got a puzzle where there are really only three possible options, Matthew used Luke, Luke used Matthew, or Matthew and Luke used another source like Q, then you have a scholarly duty to your innocent readers to explore all three possibilities, rather than say, nobody's bothered to explore possibility three, so I'm not going to bother either. On that basis, we'll never explore other possibilities. And actually, I think that one of the key roles of the scholar is to keep trying new solutions to difficult problems. And if what our scholars actually do is ossify, so that they only consider possibilities which have been tried for the previous 90 years, we'll never make any progress, will we? If you think I'm angry, I really am. But let's go back to Streeter. He's not all bad. He has some great ideas. He proposes three things that are true. There are substantial obstacles to Luke's use of Matthew. Matthew's use of Luke is a, quotes, obvious explanation for the double tradition, the blue material. And alternating primitivity implies the presence of a source or sources shared by Matthew and Luke. All those things are completely reasonable things to say. And if you put them together, what you get is not this, but I'm going to reproduce this diagram on its side, exactly the same arrows, okay? Just a little change you have to make to Streeter's hypothesis, which is that Matthew used Luke. And if Matthew used Luke, then a lot of this blue material doesn't have to come from Q. It could just be Matthew using Luke. So that shrinks the size of Q a lot. And actually, it means that Q could be any number of documents, written or oral. And I've tried to express that in having lots of little Qs in quotation marks. And I call this solution to the synoptic problem the Matthew conflator hypothesis. Now, really, the main difference between this hypothesis and Streeter's two-document hypothesis is Matthew using Luke. So I'm going to take just a few moments to try and convince you that Matthew really did use Luke. Okay? I'm not going to give you the full works. I can point you to a talk on the internet which will give you the full works, but just one or two arguments for thinking that Matthew is very likely to have used Luke directly. Look at that. What I want you to notice there is the level of verbatim agreement between Matthew and Luke in John's preaching on repentance, which is one of those passages that you wouldn't really expect to be reproduced in a lot of different places. If it's green, it's exactly the same. And actually, if you know Greek a little bit, then you can see that the black bits are virtually the same. So the impression I want you to get here is that these passages are almost identical. This is the most identical passage in the whole of the case. This is the second most identical, third most identical, fourth most identical. Really, really similar. Now, if you were a teacher and you got two exam papers with this level of similarity, you might think that one person was directly copying from the other, wouldn't you? That would be your first guess anyway. You wouldn't be thinking, I think that Jones probably copied from Barnes. Well, Ellis was also copying from Barnes, even though Jones and Ellis were sitting, you know, in the same environment. Because they were both close enough to Barnes to be able to see him. But what Streeter and followers argue instead is that, the sun's slightly our enemy here, isn't it? Is that what's happened is not that Luke's copied directly from Matthew or Matthew's copied directly from Luke. They've both been really faithful to Q to this kind of extent. Now, remember that Mark can serve as a control for us. They ought to treat Mark in the same way that they treat Q. The same type of relationship. If we go for, so that's 85% compound agreement. That's to say that in order to get 85% triple agreement, you need to have, if Luke is 90% faithful to Q, then Matthew has to be 95% faithful to Q. That's really faithful. In an environment, in the first century where direct copying is very rare. Gets more as you get later into the second century. But in the first century, you were really thought to be not quite doing your job if you just copied straight. You were supposed to paraphrase. And we have a good example of that in Josephus, when he uses Jewish sources to produce his Antiquities, the history of the Jewish people. Now, if we look for the fourth most agreeing bit of the triple tradition, where Mark is in the middle, there's actually only 33% triple agreement, which suggests that there's something funny going on. It would be really surprising if Matthew and Luke, given all their differences from one another, would be electrically faithful to Q, which is supposed to be a very primitive document. These days, people talk about it being the product of village scribes in Galilee. And both Matthew and Luke think, this Greek is fantastic. This theology is amazing. I want to reproduce it exactly, even though Matthew and Luke are quite different from one another. But it isn't the way that they treat Mark. But a possible explanation for their very big faithfulness to Q, some would say, is that Q has much more words of Jesus in it. I think it's a spurious argument, but let's follow it through. Very fortunately, it just so happens that the number of words of Jesus in Mark's gospel are virtually identical to the number of words of Jesus in so-called Q. Isn't that handy? So we can do, it is a bit rough actually, it's not perfect, but we'll come to the final slide is important in this sequence. It ought to be the case that if the triple agreement between Mark, Matthew, Luke and Q, the words of Jesus, should be roughly the same as the triple agreement between Matthew, Luke and Mark in Mark. And here's a little diagram that just puts that in a picture. These bars, that bar there is created by a string of verbatim agreement between Matthew and Luke, which is 10 words long. They've all got the same words, 10 words in a string, and that happens 4 times. That's how you get a string of 40. So this diagram just gives you a rough sense of the amount of exact agreement there is. Yep. Yeah, I'm not doing that. All I'm doing is we'll come to what it would need to be in order for the... You can define what it is by where Matthew and Luke agree exactly. Because where Matthew and Luke agree exactly, when you're reconstructing Q, you say, well, that must be what Q had. And that's what these guys have done. When I showed you that packed stack of books, that's the process they've gone through to publish this lovely volume of the critical edition of Q. It was a very handy thing to have done, because it means that you've got something concrete to fire at. But it is a text of Q. So it doesn't look very likely that Matthew and Luke have both treated Mark in the way they treated Q. Are you with me on that? Yeah? Well, what about if Luke used Matthew? If Luke used Matthew, we'd expect that Luke would be faithful to the words of Jesus in Matthew in much the same way as he'd be faithful to the words of Jesus in Mark. Yeah. Come into Matthew and Luke, yeah. I don't think so. I think if you could be really confident that Matthew and Luke didn't have any contact with one another, which we can't, but if you could, which these guys think you can, then Q has to exist. Because there's no other way of explaining, or something like Q has to exist, because there's no other way of explaining why they're so similar. What I'm driving at now is the level of similarity between them suggests that there's direct copying. That's the obvious explanation for the high levels of agreement. The people who believe in Q say, no, that's not the explanation. It's because they're both very faithful to Q. And I'm just running through a little, I'm going to get to a slide now which will finish this particular line. There's a much better explanation for the very high levels of agreement, which is not that they're both copying somebody who's sitting in the row in front. One's copying from the guy sitting next to him. There's no need for this extra complication of Q. Okay.
Nope.
We don't know when they're writing. Until we've solved this problem, we don't know when they're writing.
Do we know how long they live?
Nope. We know nothing about them.
Are you confusing by saying they knew each other? I think you mean they.
Thank you, Stuart. That's very helpful. Yeah. It is, and also because it's about the each other. Actually, what we're talking about in the end is one person is copying from someone else's text. That's the best explanation for the levels of agreement between them. No? If I wrote a book in 1924 and you had a copy of it, you could copy it. No, exactly. We're only talking about one direction of copying. That is confusing the way I'm putting it because I'm trying to be even-handed saying it could go either way. Actually, I'm going to say it's Matthew copying Luke. That's the explanation for the phenomenon. Okay? Or Matthew copying Luke's text. Thank you very much for being brave enough to ask questions. Yeah, Brian. Jeff, I mean, sorry. Yes.
And that's the argument against Streeter.
Yeah.
But where you are heading, you've got to be Matthew. Not being terribly fussed about how he treats Mark, but being very pedantic about how he treats Luke.
Let me get to another slide.
Okay.
But brilliant, really, really good questions. Very helpful, because it's complicated. It fries your brain, doesn't it? But don't let that stop you from engaging, because it can be made clear if I do a good job. We'd expect Luke to treat Mark in the same way as Luke would treat Matthew, but he doesn't. It's closer. But this is where we're headed. Can you see that? It's better. We have the graph is more similar. But if Matthew used Luke, which is what I'm arguing for, what we would expect is that Matthew's attitude to the words of Jesus in Luke would be the same, Jeff, as Matthew's attitude to the words of Jesus in Mark, yeah? How's that? That is a pretty impressive diagram. Because you can't, that's completely unconscious. You're taking a sample of Jesus' words in Matthew. Jesus' words in Mark. Where does Matthew copy them exactly? That's the diagram at the bottom. A string of verbatim agreement. Thank you for that question. Yeah?
Is there a danger that the scribes who initially first copied the Gospels, if they're trying to actually understand what they're putting down,
yep,
will tend to look at other sources, other Gospels, and actually incorporate the understanding, if not the wording, in what they're saying?
Yeah, I think it works both ways. There's a tendency to become more similar, as well as mistakes that generate dissimilarity. So the one thing that's neat about this diagram, I think, is that it's looking at a large enough sample to say that this is an overall pattern that you wouldn't spot if you were just reading the text. It does, as it happens, Matthew's attitude to Luke is the same as Matthew's attitude to Mark. That suggests that Matthew is copying Luke. Yes? So say that again?
Not necessarily the same initial source.
Oh, no. Yeah, this is why we have to talk in broad terms. I quite like using the idea of the plate tectonics theory. We've got lots of phenomena to explain. We've got South America fitting into Africa. Now, it's not a perfect fit because there's been lots of attrition, bits of continents being knocked off, but you can see how they roughly fit together. And that's all that we can hope to achieve in this setting and from this distance. There's a phenomenon we need to explain, which is this. Why is there such close agreement between Matthew and Luke? There's nothing to stop us from saying it's because Matthew copied Luke directly. Streeter said there was because of alternating productivity. That's not true. There's no need to appeal to Q. Q is a completely unnecessary entity to explain passages like this, isn't it? Yeah? There's no need for it. It's just Rowan Atkinson copying from the guy next door. That's all it is. Paul. Well spotted. Yeah. Almost all dating of New Testament texts is pretty arbitrary. And anything which is dated between 80 and 100, which is where these two are generally put, is as a kind of dustbin for places we don't know quite where to date them. I think there's a general assumption that because Matthew's gospel is more Jewish and Luke's gospel is more Gentile, and the trajectory is from Jewish to Gentile and the growth of the Jesus movement, that Luke reflects a later period. But that's really not necessary. If Luke was Paul's companion, then there's a need for a Gentile gospel at a very early period. And if Matthew is trying to recover something of the Jewish heritage, then you just need one person to create that gospel. So it is, yeah, you're quite right. That is the general assumption. It's an assumption based on nothing very much at all.
Some 40 years ago, yeah. I read John Robbins.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seemed very convincing when he demonstrated how little we know, though he was less convincing.
Yeah, he's a great example of somebody who comes in and says, let's try something different, rather than copying the speculation which has been accumulating through generations of scholars. Because scholars are really, really, really do not like disturbing the slight stepping stones of solidity that we have, because it makes very difficult to go on from there. Yeah, absolutely right. We know very little. We're looking down a tube which is 2,000 years long. Almost entirely on internal evidence, quite true. Last one, Jeff, because we'll get to the break in a second.
Just for pre-critical scholarship.
Yeah.
Matthew was always thought to be first, but the critics of Mark was just an abbreviated version of Matthew.
Yeah.
So the priority of Matthew was deep in the tradition.
Yes, yes, true.
Which makes it bigger, imagine,
to put it right at the end.
Yeah.
I am going to stop in a second, really.
It's just that I think we need to start using microphone for questions, because a lot of people are missing the question.
I'm going to stop questions now. I'm just going to get to the end of this section, then we're going to have a break. But Jeff's point was that historically, in the medieval period, there was an assumption that Matthew was first. So it's a bigger step to put Matthew last. It's a good point. So Matthew copying Luke is a good explanation for all those bits. Matthew closely copied Luke just as he also closely copied Mark. It's easy. There's no mystery about it. Yeah? There's only a mystery if you make the mistake of thinking there must be a Berlin Wall between Matthew and Luke, and there's no need for it. And so you end up with this diagram. But you might be wondering, why do you need those bits of Q at all? Can you manage without them? Come back after the break. And I'll explain why we need Q a bit. And because we need Q a bit, there's a possibility that we have Q and you might even be sitting on a copy of it right now.
So if we take a break for about 15 minutes and back by 20 past, is that okay? Lovely.